Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is always a pleasure when you're in the house with me. It just makes it that much more fun, the more people you have inside the room. So I'm so glad you could be with us for our conversation. I'm really excited about this. We were just talking a little bit before we got started. My guests and I were kind of going back and sort of saying hello. And I was just really, really stoked to get this gentleman in the room and a part of our conversation. He's one of those strong silent types. Let's just put it that way. You know, he's one of these guys that is in a lot of places that a lot of us are never in, but we're so glad he's there. He is the former commanding officer of SEAL Team 2, leading a 2,000-person special operations task force in southeastern Afghanistan. In addition to a 20-year career as a SEAL, my guest, Mike Hayes, was a White House fellow, served 2 years as Director of Defense Policy and Strategy at the National Security Council, which is no small stokes, folks, let me tell you, and has worked directly with both Presidents George W. Bush and President Barack Obama. He's currently the Chief Digital Transformation Officer at VMware and has written a book which I think speaks to a lot of things that we oftentimes overlook and forget about and don't really take into account. It's entitled Never Enough, A Navy SEAL Commander on Living a Life of Excellence, Agility, and Meaning. Welcome, Mike Hayes.
Michael Steele, such a pleasure. And I have to start by saying thank you for all the incredible positive impact you've had on the nation and the globe. So I'm humbled to be here with you, my friend.
Oh, man, I appreciate you. Well, look, I appreciate you being on that wall out there over the years. And in many ways, you still are in the work you're continuing to do. And I think that's exciting. And so the couple of ways I was really kind of trying to frame it. So how do I want to start this conversation with Mike? Because there's so many different doors to go through, particularly in light of recent news about President Biden's decision in Afghanistan, and you know that theater very well. But I think I probably want to go in a different direction. I'm going to pull up a quote from your book. And it was really interesting because it literally was the first paragraph of the first chapter. And it is not that often that you get caught, at least it was for me, to get caught in the moment and realize, damn, I can relate to that. And you'll understand why in a moment. So the quote, you open your book, the title is Choose the Hard Path. And you say, I was in Kosovo in 1999, in the middle of winter, leading a small surveillance team in the mountains, just a few hundred meters from the Serbian border. Freezing cold temperatures, the darkness of night, howling winds, and both Kosovar Serbian and Albanian armies, somewhere in that same snowy terrain, weapons ready, looking for an enemy to fight. It doesn't get much harder than that. And what I took from that opening sentence, that opening paragraph, was sometimes we lose sight of the difficulties of the situations we're in, or we don't fully appreciate the fullness of that difficulty in the situation we're in. And your book is about making those hard choices, but doing so with a mindset of excellence and integrity and really kind of understanding your environment, understanding your situation, so that you can be your best person. walk us through why you opened with that scene, with that under that title, Making Hard, Choose the Hard Path.
Thanks, Michael. It's really a metaphor for life, like you point out. You know, a lot of people look at success and failure as binary. You either succeed or you fail. I like to think of that you have to go down the logic tree one more branch, failure, and then you go, did you learn or did you not learn? And it's only failure if you fail and didn't learn. If you failed and learned, you just got better. And so, feeding back into, ourselves as individuals or our organizations ultimately is what helps us to learn. Look, life is long. We all are imperfect. We're all on the journey together to try to have more meaning and impact, which is ultimately what Never Enough is about. And I think it starts with ourselves and making those hard decisions and leaning into those hard things. For me, Michael, I think that a lot of people get stuck on the 5-yard line, afraid to make that really hard choice because we start subconsciously thinking, gosh, are the people around me going to think less of me if I try right. and don't succeed? And the thing I would emphasize is, man, if the people around you in your life are going to think less of you because you tried the really hard thing and learned, then you're not around the right people. And so that's really the essence. And so it's really a metaphor for life, Michael.
It's interesting because that jump off point, and there's another quote I'll get to in a moment, which defines for me, which is my definition of leadership, which is a very specific kind of approach to circumstances and situations. And like I said, I'll get to that in a moment. But what struck me in about your book was a lot of times it's folks take, a book by a military guy is going to talk about some great campaign or some, intricacies of war and peace, quite honestly. But you get into that, you relate it to circumstances and situations as you did in the opening, being in the, you can almost picture being in the dead of winter in some place and, oh, there are a whole bunch of guys with guns out there trained on me too. But then you raise the bar to the point where you talk about the leadership that's required, the circumstances, the situation, the talent, the skills, the training, all of those things that sort of led to your being in that moment, to being in that field in the dead of winter, doing the mission. You weren't just a member of SEAL Team 2, you commanded SEAL Team 2. So that's another level. I mean, to get to that kind of leadership position requires a number of strokes along the way. What was it in your journey leading up to that moment when your commanding officer said to you, hey, I got a job, and oh, by the way, you're now going to be in charge of it?
Well, let me start by saying my grandfather was at Pearl Harbor on that day of infamy and really wow. lived a life of service. And so I grew up really seeing what service was, hearing what service was. My father was a career naval officer. None of them ever pushed the Navy on me. It was just, how do we as humans make sure we give more than we take? And then, my grandfather also put his hand on my shoulder the day that I got commissioned in the Navy and days later was off to SEAL training. But I'll never forget him looking me square in the eyes. And this is a combat veteran himself who had been shot at in multiple places as a helicopter pilot after being mm-hmm. on a ship at Pearl Harbor. And he said, Michael, don't die for your country. Go on living for it. And I thought, later in my career, you think to those whom much has been given, much is expected. And so I had been in the Navy for 8 or so years when 9/11 happened. And I kind of had this like, if not me, then whom? The ultimately leadership in the SEALs and in the military writ large or just in life is ultimately to me about figuring out what are the right outcomes to go achieve. What is it that we're really trying to do? Mm-hmm. And then looking at the strategies of how to get there and assuming the least amount of risk that we can to go achieve that outcome. And not everybody's great at that. There's a lot of things that I'm really not good at, but I'm pretty good at the other thing. And so,
you're good at the important stuff. Let's put it that way. Well,
but everybody's got different positions. It's like some people are in the outfield, some people pitch, and some people catch, and some people, so we all have different interests and abilities and skills. And so for me, it was very much about really making sure that we're driving toward the right outcomes and only assuming risk we should assume. The nation entrusted her sons and daughters in my care and in command. So it was very, very important to me to make sure that we were doing the things that we were supposed to be doing.
So walk us through a little bit of the book, the things that for you, you felt it was important. It was important to share. You have the book divided up in ways where the first part of it, which we the first chapter we're talking about, you talk about never excellent enough, and you just kind of alluded to some of that, never agile enough, and then you end it with never meaningful enough. What are those three aspects, attributes of service, leadership, responsibility? How do those ideas of never being you're never excellent enough, you're never agile enough, and you're never meaningful enough?
It's a great question, and I'm not sure I've ever answered it this way, but it's a parallel to kind of what I think about the phases of a career. You know, I like to, when I'm mentoring younger kids, like we all do, really draw out three phases. The first is go become as best as you can at the foundational level of whatever it is that you choose. Mm-hmm. Then the second phase is really trying to show the world that you're really darn good at what you've chosen. And then a lot of people never make it to that third circle, that third phase, which is being so comfortable knowing that you're good at something that you can just back off and just not be ashamed to stand in front of a room and say, I don't know, but we'll figure it out. And that's when you really unlock the value and the ability to create positive impact for the world. And so for me, the parallel to the book, Michael, was excellence is that first part of like, how do I get as good as I humanly can, or my organization get as good as possible? And a lot of people think that's about them, like having their name up in lights or self-promotion. It's not. To me, excellence is about the more excellent I am and strive to be, the more I can give to others and the more I can pull others up. And then that second phase of the book, the agility, to me is really about being able to know what to be. I like to say that, as you read in the book, leaders don't need to make the best decision. They need to make sure the best decision gets made. And that's there's a real nuance there. And that means you're comfortable sitting back and seeing others in your organization make that decision. So as a leader, you're when do you move to the front? When do you move to the back? And how do you know when to be which? And then, of course, that third part of the book, Michael, what we talked about, it's all about meaning. It's all about what impact we have.
Right. Well, this is where I connected with you on the book. And I knew that we would be simpatico and understanding the moment. So it's in section 2, chapter 4. You have the perfect title because it goes exactly to my core definition of leadership. It's entitled "Be a Leader and a Follower, and Know When to Be Which: Agility in the Roles You Play." So here is my philosophy on leadership. And this is why I know you and I are like cut out of the same cloth here, because when I was a young man of about mid-20s, taking a little bit more responsibility, sort of assessing and kind of figuring out, okay, what the hell am I going to do? What's life all about? Oh my God, I'm going to get married. Oh my God, all these things, all these responsibilities. But then the other side of it was just how I began to move into various rooms and circles and began to sort of, like you said, try to be my best in the thing that I think or believe I want to do. And out of all of that, over time, I formed this definition of leadership. A leader is someone who's always prepared to lead, but never afraid to follow. And what I loved about this chapter, and I think I actually pull it because I pulled a quote from it, if I'm not mistaken. A section. You talk about the truth is that in any given moment on any particular mission, hierarchy doesn't and shouldn't matter. If hierarchy is getting in the way of the best decision being made or precluding the best person from taking on any particular role, then something is deeply wrong. And that lined up so much with my philosophy, because a leader is someone who in the moment understands this moment doesn't require my leadership. it requires yours. And so I'm going to give to you the power and authority to lead in this moment. Yeah, I'm ultimately going to be the responsible one because if you know what hits the fan, yeah, I've got to go talk to some people. I got that. But I'm not afraid of that. That's the part of not being afraid to follow, because the fear is, well, if I give it to Mike and he screws it up, that's on me. That you don't want that to get in the way. What you want is to recognize that Mike Hayes not only has the talent, but he has the talent required in this moment. So as the leader, I'm going to let you do it. Did you find yourself as a commander, as a commander of SEAL Team 2 in that moment? And it sounds like those words were kind of born out of some experiences in the field where you said, Corporal, Captain, whatever, I need you to be on point here. And I need you guys to take his point. How does that evolve for you? Because that's a lot to give up. A lot of folks don't give up that kind of power in their leadership. And those words, I think, speak to that.
Well, Michael, I couldn't have just chosen better words to say it. So there's not much to layer onto what you just did, but I can throw something at the wall and see if it sticks. Look, I believe that, as the leader of an organization, like you said, you own the outcomes of the organization. And so then you say to yourself, well, why wouldn't I want the person who is A, best at the thing that we're doing, and then B, closest to the problem, to be the one to make the decision? If I want my organization to succeed, then my goodness, it's just common sense that the person closest right. to better should make that should be the person who moves to the front while I move to the back. The right. only reason not to is ego or desire for credit. And that's the best way to break down a team. Whenever the perception that credit or blame will be disproportionately shared, that's when teams break down.
Right. Yes. And you see it all the time. And you wonder why. Is that a failure of
culture?
Culture? I was going to say what drives that environment that those moments are missed or that failure emerges?
I really do believe it's culture, because when you're going through SEAL training, my class started with 120 guys and 19 graduated. The thing wow. that all 19 have in common is that we care. There's a saying which you also would have read in the book, teammate self. The team comes first and foremost. And so if all you want is the credit for the team and the success of the team, then by definition, you're putting yourself behind the team. And it's very easy to say, it's easy to, cliche for a reason or whatever, to put the team first, but it's harder to do. So I think culture is where you really set the ability to say, hey, none of us need any credit. Look, I just turned 50 a few weeks ago. The number of times in my last, I like to say I just lived the first third of my life. There's so much, right. to, really the reason that we get worried sometimes is that somebody else might get the credit. But if you already don't care, then you've already won on that culture front.
So I'm gonna take a quick break here, because now that we've sort of laid the foundation of your story and the narrative behind Never Enough, I want to ascribe the lessons to real life and some of the stupid and not so stupid we find ourselves having to deal with today. Folks, we're having a great conversation with former commanding officer of SEAL Team 2, Mike Hayes. He is the author of the new book, Never Enough. It's out now. I highly recommend you get it. I don't bring stuff to you unless it's good. So it's good. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to have a little bit more fun with Mike Hayes right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. Still Michael Steele. And we're having a wonderful conversation with Mike Hayes. I feel like he's a buddy. I mean, we've been talking for just a short time, but I just feel like, I remember that time when we were, on this mission and we had a cold beer. I just kind of feel, I had that vibe with you. It was really, really good. Mike, How do you look at where we are now? And it's not just the politics. You use the word I think is important to also put into play, and that's culture. And there are other aspects and elements of what's going on around us today that, you know, actually kind of led to what we saw happen on January 6th, what we see now playing out on the other side of that narrative. How do you, as someone who has, you served under two presidents and both parties, so you have the balance of perspective. How do you see the lessons of never enough, and the current situations that we find ourselves in kind of coming together?
Yeah, it's a great topic, Michael. I think at the most elemental level, we have an opportunity to become better decision makers. And let me explain. Our nation's forefathers created this great nation to disagree agreeably and to be able to respect the fact that we have different viewpoints. And to me, those differences are what makes us strong. You know, and so by bringing all of our different selves and identities and experiences and creative ideas to the table, how do we argue or fight or push for what we believe in? But then at the same time, when we don't win, we don't get so nasty and mean to the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, and just understand, like, really to judge people on intent, not action. You know, there are not a lot of people that I've ever seen in the professional workspace that show up to work and say, what can I go screw up today? You know, most people are pretty darn well-intentioned.
Right.
How do we elevate the game? How do we pull others up?
Although I had to say, Mike, I've run into a few where, and they wouldn't be too far from asking that question, but I get your point.
Yeah, but hopefully you fired them within a few days. You know?
Yeah, so, right, so, exactly.
I think that's the essence of it, Michael, is how do we get along when we have different viewpoints? When I was the commanding officer of a SEAL team, and running everything in Afghanistan, a lot of times I had to make hard decisions. I was the person that decided what operations we went on, and frankly, when aircraft dropped bombs in different hard situations to stop bad people from doing bad things to good people. Mm-hmm. And these are decisions you don't want to get wrong. And so, you know, I separated myself as not just the decider, but separately as an input, and then got a bunch of other inputs. And see, the thing is, like, we all are human. We all can see, I don't know, 270 degrees. How do we see the 90 degrees behind us? That takes teammates. That takes people who are different than we are. That takes people who can sit across the table and like artists will hire artists and engineers will hire engineers. But if you're the artist, how do you get the engineer around you or vice versa? And you get that alternate viewpoint that says, hey, boss, we might not be thinking about this quite right. Oh, okay. Let's figure that out. What are you seeing? What are you thinking? What are you, and really wrestle that to the ground and then make the best possible decision.
Well, Michael, I I'm all on board with what you're saying, but how do we, I'm not going to put the weight of the world on your shoulders, but since you've got broad shoulders, I'll give it a shot. How do we, you talk a lot about in the book, and it's really sort of a theme about, you know, living lives of purpose, right? So there's meaning, there's substance. But if we're not sure, and if our leaders especially aren't sure what the purpose is, how do you live that life? How do you do that better thing? How do you stop bad people from doing bad things to good people when you no longer recognize what the bad thing is?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we have now people who are sitting there going, oh, well, Joe Biden didn't win the election, or, you know, January 6th was nothing more than a tourist event.
Yeah.
Where's the purpose there? How do you do that?
I've got two thoughts. Number one is we have to do a better job of talking about the goal of what we're trying to do. You know, let's talk about the things that transcend any sort of dichotomy in the country, whether it's the right and the left or the rich and the poor or any dichotomy that you make.
Right.
And so let's all understand, the more dialogue we have around what we're actually trying to be and who we're trying to achieve, that will help us unite and see what the end goal is. And then the second thing I think is to your point about, you know, about the January 6th or fraudulent elections, like, let's have better data-driven conversations, you know, like let's not just take other people's word for what somebody said that somebody said that somebody else said. Now that's right. My opinion. Let's get smarter, America. Let's really understand real data and come to our own critical thinking and say, and challenge, ask questions and figure it out for yourself.
So you've got a lot of that. You've got a lot of that underpinning because you were a freaking Navy SEAL. I mean, you already shared with us indirectly the quality and the character of the man when you said, yeah, we were a class of 119 or 120, only 19 of us graduated. You were one of 19 out of 120 who made it through. So you've got that thing that defines leadership and works in that space. So if you're not there, if you're not a Navy SEAL, right? If you're not that kind, you're not in that structure, because a lot, you know, our situation culturally and otherwise today is a lot more loose than it was certainly when I was growing up. And so how do you navigate that, and how do you move people into that space where a lot of the attributes and qualities you're describing and that you've written about that are tied to real life experiences, right? How do you get that? Where does it come from?
Yeah, well, I would challenge you a little bit on one part of this, Michael, and that's that. Yes, okay, I was a SEAL, but everybody has different gifts and abilities and interests. You know, I couldn't be in the NFL, I couldn't be a doctor, I couldn't be, I couldn't cut someone's hair, I couldn't sing. You know, I'm the guy that can watch American Idol and tell you in 6 seconds whether you can sing, but I damn sure can't do it, you know?
Right,
and so,
right.
So how do we as a nation celebrate all of the different people who can do all the different things and draw that out? And so I think what that ties to the second point that I'd emphasize, which is get off the sidelines and use the gifts that you have to make the people around you better. That's ultimately what's going to make us stronger and make the fabric of society, our families, our teammates, ultimately our teammates to the right and left of us in any town or city or state, and really see each other like teammates trying to win a common cause, which is making life better for all of us.
Because what that gets me to think about. So how do you tell when something is worth the risk or when it's not worth the risk? Because that kind of feeds into this whole idea that we've been talking about around, you know, leadership and the roles that are played out in that space. But at the end of the day, it also fundamentally comes down to, put it this way, does it come down to your better understanding of your own self and your own limitations and aspirations and abilities in the moment? And because I do take to heart what you said about, well, yeah, I know I couldn't do an NFL thing. I mean, you know, I played street football and damn near got killed. So I was like, you know what? I think I'll just watch. So you quickly learn what your limitations are. But then I guess the question is, for some people, that then leads to some level of defeatism, because do they then not see that limitation as a jump off point to, oh, let me focus on the fact that this, I am probably better at this. I can't, like you said, yeah, I can tell who can't sing, but I start with, I know I can't, right? So it's that kind of understanding in the process of that creates that leadership.
You used the best word a few minutes ago, perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And see, you know, as we are on the planet longer and longer, I think we get more and more perspective. Wisdom is really just a series of learnings that comes mostly from mistakes and where we've fallen short.
Right.
And so the obligation now, and this is ultimately why I wrote Never Enough, which is to try to give back. You know, if I just wrote a book of all the things I've done right and the president of my fan club, that wouldn't be a book. You know, and so how do you share what you've learned with many other people to try to pull us up? And that's where I think that that defeatism word that you said, it could creep in, but how do we not let it creep in for either ourselves or our, you know, family, friends, teammates, and citizens? That's the most important thing, is we need to celebrate the people leaning in and trying to bring the positive attributes to others that comes from that wisdom and that perspective.
So let's tie a little bit more into the current news that we are all kind of trying to get our heads around and understand what it means. And you actually wrote a piece. It was Michael O'Hanlon wrote a piece about the president's decision that we should leave Afghanistan. First off, what is your take on that, having served there and knowing firsthand the limitations and the opportunities on the ground? And then secondly, what does it potentially mean, and what kind of leadership should we as everyday citizens should be looking and listening for with respect to something that that takes us oftentimes so close to life and death?
Absolutely. I did write something that was published in Time, and I did support that President Biden made the right decision to end the war in Afghanistan. And ultimately,
there you did. Yes, I'm sorry. I had two mics in front. I do apologize.
Oh no, all good.
I had Michael Hanian's piece, and then I had your piece, and your piece actually in the Times was President Biden made the right choice to withdraw from Afghanistan. So I do apologize for that.
Oh, yeah. No stress at all. What I was going to emphasize is that ultimately back to how do we make decisions? And there are, at the end of the day, we have national security is at the forefront of you know, Department of Defense, a lot of the interagency, and ultimately the White House. So we have a system where, you know, the leadership of the Department of Defense is going to bring their best military advice forward. And then the National Security Council and ultimately the president are going to make a decision of what they believe to be best. So I think the thing that should be celebrated all in all here is that the system works. And see, you know, you can, anybody in America can agree or disagree with any single decision. But the beauty is we might bump our way down the highway, but we're not going to leave the road. You know, we as a nation might go right, a little bit left, but we're going to get down the road. And so for me personally, with the decision in Afghanistan, as somebody who contributed to the effort over the years, I'll say that Afghanistan was, in my opinion, no longer in our national interest. We ultimately entered there because of the transnational threat. And today, the transnational threats are much greater in other locations. And ultimately, I think that what gets underestimated is the value of resting and recovering for the force. Could the I'm certain that the uniform leadership of the military, when they say, hey, we can keep a small force there, absolutely. Of course they could. And never in a million years would the uniform leadership bring forward advice that they wouldn't be able to back up. That just would not happen. So the thing that is the calculus that has to be made is opportunity cost. And so we as a nation can never see what's around the next corner. And so the decision is, even though it might sound like just 2,500 people, a force of uniformed members to stay in Afghanistan that was being recommended, it's a lot more than just 2,500 people when you add contractors, money, the bandwidth that it takes from staff, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot. It's a little bit misleading as readers of a newspaper to say, oh, it's just 2,500 people, no big deal. No. So personally, the way I net it out is that resting and recovering and getting training and reuniting families and getting ready for the next thing, whatever that may be, or ultimately in our greater national interest than continuing to work in Afghanistan where there is no transnational threat.
So, you know, our presence in Afghanistan, the lead up to our being there, the reasons and rationale really kind of begs the question that certainly became more animated over the last 6 or 7 years. I know I got in trouble when I was national chairman and spoke out about our being there. And people were like, you shouldn't say that. I'm like, dude, I'm an American citizen, so I have an opinion. But the question that I think still comes up is, you know, in Afghanistan is I think a reasonable one to give it some context is, you know, do we start these wars too easily? Or, and when are they justified? When is that action necessary and justifiable? I know from the perspective of someone, or at least I don't know. I appreciate as someone from the perspective of someone who's answered that call to service. And you know, appreciate the chain of command and all of that. And so that duty, honor, service, commitment is there. And so it's a very different, you know, inside that, you know, inside that uniform or in that uniform and inside those rooms, you do, because that's the order, that's the mission. Now that you're outside of that, how do you see it looking back in the context of not just your service in Afghanistan, but overarching, how we have, you know, positioned ourselves? And do we look at those engagements too easily, say, yeah, let's go and, you know, get the tanks and machinery lined up to go? And when are they justified, where you just kind of go, yeah, this is a mission we got to do? We get Pearl Harbor, and for example, but that's kind of on its face obvious. 9/11 too, but then people say, well, yeah, but the Saudis were the one who attacked us, not the Afghans. So, you know, what are we doing over there?
Well, it's a great topic, Michael. And so let's go back to just war theory. There's two things to look at. There's when you fight a war and then how you fight a war. The when, just to really keep it simple, there's four components. First of all, does a potential war cause more good than harm? Mm-hmm. Number two is there a good chance for success? Number three is war a last resort? And number four is the expected outcome of that conflict peace? Now, there's a lot that can be debated in there. What's the definition of success? What's the definition of peace? What's the definition of good or more than harm, et cetera? But that's the high level framework that I think that has its roots in just war theory. And so I think that, you know, for me, when we look at what is success mean? And at this point, you know, your question is, 20 years later, our views have evolved since when we started this.
Right.
So I think to go back and say and judge the beginning of the war right now with the information that we have 20 years later is it's certainly fair, but it's and can and should be done. But also while we keep in mind that all the information that we have now, we didn't have 20 years ago.
That's fair. Because I'm the first one to complain about those who look at another period of time through today's glasses, because it looks very different. You know, what we did in the 1980s today, you used to think, oh, don't tell anybody. don't tell anybody I was at that party, you know. But back in the day, you were like, hey, you know where I was this weekend? You know, so it's that kind of vibe to it where people feel I think they become a little bit snobbish about history and using today's sort of jaundiced view of these things and these events and looking at a particular way. Okay, so before I let you get up out of here, folks, the book again is Never Enough. The author is Michael Hayes. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Do that. So once they do that, and they read the book, and they learn a lot more about you, your journey, and your philosophy on leadership and service, et cetera, what's the takeaway you want them to have when they consume Never Enough?
Thank you for the question. The takeaway is believe in something, get off the sideline, and help pull this great nation up by pulling the people up around us. You know, Michael, one thing I'd like to hit on too is that with these themes, I'm donating all my profits from this book to a nonprofit I started that pays off mortgages for Gold Star families.
Wow.
So I, like every SEAL of my era or military member of my era even, have buried far too many friends and teammates. And so, you know, at this point, I've very confidentially and quietly paid off 5 homes, all for widows of fallen service members. And for me, this book is way more than a book. It's a mission. It really is another mission. And so I'm not profiting. And I grew up in an era in the SEALs where you either showed strength or perceived strength, never asking for help. And I think one thing that we've evolved very smartly, not just in the SEALs, but just in the nation, is that we now recognize that asking for help is a sign of strength, not weakness. And so, you know, that's why I'm asking, you know, people who are on here listening, yeah, please jump on Amazon. It's, you know, $20 or whatever, and get your review in and whatnot, because the goal here is to multiple levels of goodness. First of all, I think that hopefully you'll find that the content in the book is quite good. But also what we're doing is we're helping Gold Star families here, and we're raising the conversation around veterans and people who have served. And so to me, that's what's really near and dear to my heart. And so I just greatly appreciate the help from everybody. I'm on Twitter. This is Mike Hayes. Instagram, this is .MikeHayes, and can find me on LinkedIn. But just genuinely so appreciative of you and your incredible impact, Michael.
No, dude. Well, you touched my heart with that last piece, because I was not aware that the proceeds were going to help Gold Star families. And now even more so, I'm a big fan of you and the work that you've done in this book. And I really sincerely ask the folks who like to hang out with me on this podcast, you know, to help a Gold Star family by helping this brother help them. And I really appreciate you coming on, man, and taking some time and sharing this message of hope and leadership and inspiration. I tried to keep you clean of politics as much as possible, because I thought the mission was more important than the politics. And so I just appreciate you, Mike. I really do, man.
Thank you, my brother. It's really the world. We only get to go around this place once. And so being able to be around people like you, you're the one that pulls people up. So thank you, sir.
Well, as I said, when we were talking before, I'm only able to do it because you stand on the wall. Baby, you stand on the wall, and the men and women who stood with you to secure those freedoms and to defend the values that we all believe in, regardless of party and ideology and all of the crazy stuff that seemed to distract us. It happens because of guys like you and women like you who give a damn, who, when given the choice between a partisan issue or politics or party or the country, it's USA, baby. It's USA. So we like
USA.
That.
Team we USA.
Like, Team USA. Go. Mike Hayes, he's a great one, folks. He's one for the ages. And again, I appreciate Mike coming on and spending some time with us. The book is Never Enough. It is out now. You heard from the man's mouth. This is a work of love and commitment to the community that he's from and the nation he served. And let's help him help them do your part. And so I really appreciate Mike coming on. Again, you can follow, what's your Twitter handle again, Mike?
This is Mike Hayes, all one word.
This is Mike Hayes. Check him out. Go to Amazon, get the book. And, you know, do a solid for the Michael Steele podcast. So that does it for this conversation, folks. I'm so glad you could take a moment to spend with Mike Hayes and myself. Don't forget to do that download thing. When you do, I feel all warm and fuzzy inside. So, you know, do that as often as you can. Follow me, download on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your download on. And don't forget to tune in next time for another great conversation. But this one was one for the ages, and I'm so glad Mike Hayes could come by and make it happen. So until next time, peace out, be well, enjoy the holiday, and get the damn shot, okay? Just stop being stupid and get the shot, all right? You'll feel much better, trust me. All right, until next time, later.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.